Ladies and gentlemen, good evening and welcome to the HDFC Life's FY20 Q1 Results Conference Call. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode, and there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions after the presentation concludes. Should you need assistance during the conference call, please signal an operator by pressing star, then zero on your touch-tone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I now hand the conference over to Ms. Vibha Padalkar, MD and CEO. Thank you, and over to you.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining us for the discussion on our results for the quarter ended June 30th, 2019. Our results, including the investor presentation, press release, and regulatory disclosures, are already available on our website as well as that of the stock exchanges. I have with me Suresh Badami, Executive Director, Niraj Shah, CFO, Srinivasan Parthasarathy, our Appointed Actuary, and Kunal Jain from Investor Relations. I will spend the next few minutes running through the key highlights of our quarter one FY20 results and would be happy to take questions post that. Starting with an update on business performance, the quarter ended 30th June 2019 saw stellar growth underpinned by solid performance across product categories and distribution channels. We witnessed strong traction across savings, protection, and retirement solutions while maintaining a focus on profitable growth. On the back of a YOY growth of 63% in the individual weighted received premium, WRP, our market share amongst the private insurers saw a meaningful expansion of  420 basis points from 13.3% in quarter one FY19 to 17.5% in quarter one FY20. We continue to be the market leader amongst the private insurers in terms of total new business premiums, with a market share of 25.1% in quarter one FY20 compared to 22.3% in quarter one FY19, driven by solid YOY growth of 49%. A sustained focus on the three tenets of protection, namely mortality, morbidity, and longevity, has resulted in a growth of 63% in total term protection APE, increasing from 187 crores in quarter one FY19 to 304 crores in quarter one FY20. The annuity business continues to show healthy traction, registering a year-on-year growth of 70% based on new business premiums, increasing from 409 crores in quarter one FY19 to rupees 695 crores in quarter one FY20. We covered over 1.3 crore lives this quarter, and new business sum assured was rupees 1.8 lakh crores. This represents a growth of 26% and 46% respectively over the corresponding period. We witnessed sterling growth in the value of new business, which has doubled from rupees 249 crores in quarter one FY19 to rupees 509 crore in quarter one FY20. This translated to an increased new business margin of 29.8% for the quarter. We have been able to achieve an industry-leading NBM on the back of a favorable business profile and continued cost efficiencies. Our operating return on embedded value was 19.9%. Our profit after tax grew by 12% to rupees 425 crores. The PAT increase was on the back of a healthy growth of 27% in the back book surplus. This resulted in a return on equity of 28.9%. Next, on channel performance. Our proprietary channels grew by 90%, led by agency, which grew at 121%. This has resulted in the share of our proprietary channels increasing meaningfully from 30% in quarter one FY19 to 35% in quarter one FY20 based on individual APE. Our agency channel now contributes to 15% of our individual APE as compared to 11% in the same period last year. A segmented agent recruitment strategy has helped us increase our new agent productivity by 82%. Our focus on ease of doing business for agents and higher agent engagement levels has resulted in our FLS productivity increasing by over 100%. Focus on doing quality business has resulted in our agency business enjoying best-in-class 13-month persistency of 91%. Term protection has grown by 39% in agency channel. Our direct channel, which includes online, grew by 71% in quarter one FY20. We have focused on a multidimensional approach covering branch walk-ins, telesales, digital touchpoints, cross-sell to credit protect customers, defense channels, amongst others. Our online channel continues to be our fastest growing channel. There has been a rapid expansion into savings and annuity products, with machine learning being used to improve search efficiencies and reduction of acquisition costs. Operating leverage kicked in due to strong growth, especially in our proprietary channels, and resulted in a lower OPEX ratio of 13.5% in quarter one compared to 14.4% last year. Our bank insurance channel has grown at a healthy 42% based on individual APE, with HDFC Bank recording a robust growth of 44%. This was on the back of focused efforts across multiple geographical zones and various non-branch banking verticals. In addition, several initiatives have been taken to increase branch activation, productivity, and manpower realignment. We continue to tie up with newer ecosystem partners. In our quest to build a financially secure India, we joined hands with Bharti Airtel in quarter 1 FY20 to leverage Airtel's deep distribution reach. Airtel has launched a prepaid bundle that has an inbuilt lifetime plan from HDFC Life. This arrangement makes it very simple for millions of uninsured and underinsured Indians owning a mobile phone to obtain a life cover every time they recharge their phones. We are excited about the long-term prospects of such opportunities. We have deepened our relationships with many of our existing Credit Protect partners, including Bandhan Bank, Cholamandalam Finance, Bajaj Finance, and small finance banks like Ujjivan, Utkarsh, and Suryoday, who have also tied up with us as corporate agents to market our retail insurance products. We have achieved significant growth across all distribution channels whilst maintaining a diversified distribution mix. We continue to expand our reach beyond the traditional modes of distribution, taking our partner count in excess of 270, including 40-plus new ecosystem partners. Moving on to product performance. Growth was strong across all our product segments, with our non-par savings product Sanchay Plus being received with great enthusiasm. This has led to the share of non-par savings segment of 58% based on individual APE. We expect the share of other product segments to gradually increase through the year. Our Credit Protect business continues to do well, registering a growth of 21% based on new business premium, despite a high base and slowdown on NBFC disbursements. Next, on to business quality and technology as key differentiators. Our 13-month persistency in individual business saw an increase from 83% to 85%. Our 61st-month persistency has significantly improved to 53% from 49% in the previous year. As mentioned in our previous interactions, this is on the back of an improved persistency seen in our 49th-month cohort. Moving on to technology, as we stand today, our operating model has moved away from being a traditional distributor and product play model to becoming an evolved matrix of platforms, digital channels, ecosystems, and traditional avenues fueled by technology and analytics. All our efforts are focused on building a seamless experience for the customer across the policy lifecycle, including smooth onboarding, deep integration with partner systems, hassle-free and simple servicing experience, and focus on providing a personalized experience to the customer. In quarter one, we launched HDFC Life Futurance in partnership with Ivy Camp, a unique program through which we aim to identify startups in the Indian InsurTech ecosystem that will help us solve existing challenges and build next-generation capabilities. As mentioned in our last quarter, we have gone live on our hyper-personalized sales incentive mobile application for our field sales force, which is also a first for the life insurance industry in India. The app is designed to nudge individual sales personnel to execute specific tasks and then incentivize based on the closure of the assigned tasks. This is supported at the back end by a complex machine learning engine. A quick update on our two wholly owned subsidiaries. Our pension subsidiary continues to be the number one privately owned pension fund manager in India in terms of AUM, as also the fastest growing pension fund manager under the NPS architecture. Its AUM as on June 30, 2019 was ₹5,911 crores, which is a growth of 96% over June 30, 2018. Its market share amongst all private pension fund managers grew from 23% as on June 30, 2018 to 27.7% as on June 30, 2019. The inflows of ₹764 crores in quarter 1 FY20 represented a strong growth of 64%. HDFC International Life and Re continues to forge ahead with revenues more than doubling on a YOY basis. The company also continues to trend positively on both technical and net profit. A recap of our financial performance in Q1 FY20. Starting with premiums, our individual APE and total APE have grown by 64% and 67% respectively. The value of new business has more than doubled to Rs. 509 crores. We continue to maintain industry-leading new business margins amongst listed players. Our new business margin in Q1 FY20 was 29.8%. Embedded value was Rs. 19,230 crores as on June 30, 2019, with robust operating return on embedded value of 19.9%. Our profit after tax for FY19 was Rs. 425 crores, clocking a growth of 12%. Our assets under management was Rs. 1.3 lakh crores as on 30th of June, reflecting a growth of 18%. To conclude, we are pleased to have commenced the year with a strong performance across all key metrics, providing the best value proposition to our customers, partners and shareholders. The detailed disclosures on our results is available on our investor presentation. In the end, I would like to thank all of you for your continued support of our company. We are happy to take questions now.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, we will now begin the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may please press star, then one on their touchtone telephone. If you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, you may press star, then two. Participants are requested to use handsets while asking a question. Ladies and gentlemen, we will wait for a moment while the question queue assembles. To ask a question, please press star, then one. The first question is from the line of Nitin Agarwal from Motilal Oswal. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks for the opportunity. Congratulations on a very good set of numbers. And my first question is on the non-par savings business, which has grown at such a robust rate this quarter. So how sustainable do you think that this growth momentum is? And what is the outlook on new business margins? Like, is it fair to say that we are close to peaking out on the margins?
So, you know, just taking a second question first, Nitin, on the peaking out, we were asked this question when we crossed 20%. We were asked this question when we crossed 24.6% last year. And we really have China to look at. And without giving any forward guidance, I think if we focus on doing two or three things, one is focusing on all three tenets of protection, mortality, morbidity, longevity, as well as the entire retirement space. Continuing to eke out cost efficiencies, I think there's still a long runway. On your first question on non-par, while this is on the back of a product launch, and also we had an earlier product launch last year, Q3, which was on our on the back of our deferred annuity. So a lot of innovation happening in this space. This usually happens when there's a new product. On a full year basis, we would see somewhat rationalization in terms of us having a balanced product mix. That's always been something that we have talked about. So the right product for the right set of customers through the right distribution channel. So you'll see some of that happening, but there will always be a place under the sun for non-par savings products also.
Right. Okay. And thanks for the additional disclosure this quarter, especially on the sensitivity for the non-par business. But how are we managing the interest rate risk on these guaranteed savings products? Do you think that managing this risk would be a challenge as this product gains size?
Yes, so before I hand it over to Neeraj, yes, we when you look at the sensitivity, the reason for us to put out that sensitivity and specifically on the non-par portfolio as against overall portfolio which we were looking at was to showcase low levels of sensitivity, and also Neeraj will talk through how we have moved away from looking at hedging just from a product perspective to more a category or a segment perspective. Okay, Neeraj, go ahead.
So, like we've started articulating last time, we have a fairly comprehensive approach to financial risk management, which we've actually put out on slide 20. What we've done there is also spoken about how that has actually panned out in terms of Q1. This is something that we started doing from this quarter, putting out sensitivities on our embedded value and VNB margin in light of the change in product mix to basically demonstrate that at an overall level, in spite of the change in product mix, the sensitivities to interest rate on both our embedded value and the VNB margins are within the range that you've used to see us deliver in the past. So that's mentioned in slide 20, where both on EV and VNB, it's fairly well contained. Coming specifically to the non-par products, on slide 21 of the investor presentation, what we've put out more details around how we are looking at managing risk on the non-par portfolio as a whole. So what we do is we basically look at this portfolio as two parts. The first one is the annuity business, which is a combination of both immediate and deferred annuities. And the second is the non-annuity business, which comprises protection in both retail and group, as well as non-par savings. And each of them obviously have different characteristics which we try to lay out in terms of the risks that are there. Some of them might have interest rate risk, reinvestment risk, longevity risk, and mortality. And within each product category also, we have sub-segments which have different risk characteristics, which again we've quantified here on the slide. Against each of these, we have a mitigation plan. And as a result of all of that, we basically have a metric which we track to, which is net sensitivity ratio. This is basically the relative sensitivity of assets compared to that of our liabilities. And we try and maintain a ratio as close to 1 as possible. Ratio of 1 basically means that the sensitivity of the assets is very similar or equal to that of the sensitivity of liabilities. In terms of looking at interest rate and reinvestment risk, basically we're looking at two elements. One is duration matching and second is cash flow matching. Duration matching basically helps us ensure that if there is a parallel shift in the yield curve, we are able to manage that. We do a rebalancing at very frequent intervals, and that's something that we are able to do from a duration matching perspective. On cash flows, that actually helps us manage any sort of slope change that could happen in the medium to long term. So what we basically are trying to show you here is that as a result of all of this deep thought and that goes into the way we are actually managing this portfolio, and also all of this is on the bed of what Viva mentioned in terms of a diversified product mix and a channel mix that we have, which allows us to do this. And as a result of that, what we've showed at the end is basically portfolio level non-par sensitivity itself is fairly low on embedded value. And on the VNB margin, it's no sensitivity, because by design we are trying to do both of these approaches to ensure that we are not exposed in case the interest rates move in either direction. All of this is also backed by the disciplined approach that we have in terms of periodically repricing our products as and when required, both on the annuity side as well as on the non-par savings side. In fact, we've done that about 5 to 6 times on the immediate annuity over the last 12 months. And we have recently repriced our non-par savings product as well after launching it just in the month of March. And we'll continue to do that.
Okay. The other question that I have is on the renewal premium growth. Now, that is one number which is relatively modest at 10% YOY growth, though our persistency rates have slightly improved. So, what explains the softness in the renewal premium?
So, the main reason is that when you look at the renewal premium, it's on the base. We're comparing it with quarter one of last year. And a lot of products have stopped the premium paying term. So the premiums itself, by the product architecture, the PPT ended last year itself. So there was no fresh premium that was due and hence was not received. Also, the just given our life cycle, the maturities, a lot of policies are coming up for maturities post having paid a premium in the first quarter of last year. If we were to normalize it for these two reasons, it comes up to 18%, which you'll agree is a fairly respectable growth number. And which is why you'll see the traction in 13th month as well as a 61st month persistency, but in accounting parlance, it looks like a muted growth of 9%.
Right. Thank you so much, ma'am.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, in order to ensure that the management is able to address questions from all participants in this conference call, please limit your questions to 2 per participant. If you have any further questions, you may come back for a follow-up. The next question is from the line of Adarsh P. from Nomura. Please go ahead.
Yeah, ma'am. Thanks for taking my question. Congrats and thanks for the disclosure on the interest rate sensitivity. I'll again harp on the same thing. If you can, you know, this is, you know, you've given the EV sensitivity, the internal dynamics. Just from the point of view of, you know, the kind of business we're doing on Sanchay, the run rate that we've had in the first quarter, even if a bit of that normalizes, we are looking like, again, a large book on which you need a hedge, right? These are more like, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, a 10-year pay-in product. We are doing 150, 200 crore kind of run rate on a monthly basis. So if you all can walk through the kind of, you know, the pool on which either a hedge or naturally how you're getting that hedge, firstly, and is some amount of your product cash flows will restrict how much of Sanchay Plus you could do, because you know, you'll have a certain amount of cash flow which you can invest in long tenure bonds or assets. So if you can help to give some qualitative example example and try and illustrate what's happening, it'll help us a lot.
Yeah, so Adarsh, just have the slide 20 in front of you and I'll talk in context of that and also hand it over to Neeraj and maybe Srini will also add. Two or three things here. One is my earlier comment that now we're looking at a portfolio-based hedging strategy rather than a product-based. So within the non-par segment itself, different product streams that we have sold in the past also have different liability profiles and often they have shorter tenure liability profiles which are able to have a pretty good match against some of the Sanchay Plus products. Second aspect is that Sanchay Plus has different variants and so we do manage as to what are the variants that we are selling. So it's not that all variants, everything what we are selling is very long tenured. You could also have shorter tenured. Third aspect is that on the residual strategy, we will also look at some of the aspect of residual. You know, giving a lot more than that is to some extent you'll appreciate secret sauce. That is why we have put out sensitivity just on this portfolio. Do you want to add anything, Neeraj?
Absolutely. So this is something that is coming from our ability to do this. The point that you made, others, in terms of cash flows coming from different kinds of businesses, yes, there is definitely a some sort of ability that is linked to the cash flows coming from different types of businesses, and we closely watch that. The lower duration liability products will have to kind of grow at a certain level for us to be able to afford to write a product like Sanchay Plus, and we are very absolutely closely watching that. So you can kind of take us up on that in terms of every quarter the way we will now keep sharing this result with you, and happy to engage you know to speak more on this at future points.
On your other question, Adarsh, on how much business can we write, I think we have enough in the kitty to be able to grow even at these levels continued. Not that I'm saying that that's what we will do, but if that's how it pans out, we have enough in terms of underlying assets to be able to write business against it.
Okay, so broadly clarifying that even if you continue the run rate, you have the kind of cash flows from various products which you're able to match you know, at least the reinvestment risk.
Correct. And the residual risk being very, very negligible. You want to add anything, Shreen?
But if you don't have any cash flows, we won't take stupid calls and keep writing these books. That's the only thing we can comfort. Because
yeah,
if we don't have any such books to write on, then we don't sort of, just for the sake of top line, we won't be chasing this book. So that's what I can add.
And last question on the same topic would be, can you just broadly talk about, you know, you said different variants of Sanchay Plus. So can you broadly talk about the, you know, the duration of the liability here broadly on a Sanchay Plus pool, what you've written in the last 3-4 months, what will be the duration of the liability here?
So Adarsh, again, you know, the we wouldn't really want to get into individual level durations. The reason why we are talking about this whole portfolio apart from other than annuities, so it's, just go back to on slide 21, the immediate annuity and the deferred annuity portfolio on a standalone basis is basically kind of matching each other in terms of duration between assets and liabilities. The non-annuity portfolio by its in the composite form is basically again well matched. That's the reason why the sensitivities are very small on the embedded value and are not there for VNB margins. The very fact that we're writing this business on non-par savings is because we have these other liability profiles which on a composite basis give us duration matching for both assets and liabilities. We wouldn't really want to get into you know, individual product level durations. I mean, you could, I mean, actually plot it. I mean, it's very easy to plot cash flows and generate a duration for any liability profile. But our approach is something that we're just trying to articulate to you.
Perfect. This helps. Thanks a lot. And again, congrats.
Thanks, Avish.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Nischint Chawathe from Kotak Securities. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Congrats on a good set of numbers. Just a couple of specific questions on this. When you are pricing the non-par product or, you know, on the margin calculation essentially, would you consider the 96% 13-day persistency that you have actually experienced in the quarter?
See, 13th month, if I assume higher persistency, it's actually going to be not as prudent from a margin perspective. So we assume a little lower than 96% because if we actually assume 96%, I'll be overstating the profits. So I don't assume 96%. I'll err on the side of caution and be a little bit conservative in my estimates, so at least start off with. But then later on, the later years, yes, the higher persistency actually reduces the profits, and therefore in the later years, I've assumed almost close to, you know, even higher than your 96%
you referred to. So, Nishin, there's a philosophy, if I go back and look at all the pricing assumptions on persistency-related assumptions going back in time across a cohort, not just non-par, usually we would err on side of abundant caution. And after we start getting a fair amount of experience, maybe 3 or 4 years down the line, that's when we might start calibrating it closer to actual experience. But when we don't have enough experience, then it's not. So this 96% that you see is not necessarily the product, the latest kid on the block, and it would usually be business that we have written last year, and so there would be fair amount of caution exercised.
And in terms of sensitivity to this, you know, would this be kind of, I mean, intuitively I would expect that the sensitivity would be more than the sensitivity of the overall, you know, all products put together.
Yeah, hedge, right?
So Nischint, again, sensitivity.
I'm talking about sensitivity to persistency.
Persistency sensitivity, right?
Yeah.
Persistence sensitivity usually is lower. Unit link will be the highest, right?
So like I said, I've been very prudent in the persistency assumptions for Sanchay Plus. One, because I don't know how the person is going to be. So whatever gives me the lowest profit, I've assumed that persistency assumptions.
Yeah, and also, Nishant, you know, in a falling interest rate scenario, we would expect at least for the more evolved customer to really stay persistent. You know, and so it not being as rampant as it is. Yes, there could be some amount of not knowing what policy they have bought syndrome, but we would also, it's also our job, and we will be reaching out to customers to explain to them that they're actually in the money based on the policy that they have bought.
And in this margin, you would have assumed the interest rate at the beginning of the quarter, right? Or at a point of time in the quarter?
See, they are all hedged, right? So, like I said, we won't write this business if we don't have sufficient hedging mechanism in place. And since we've already locked into those yields at which we have priced the products, then, you know, it doesn't matter whether, you know, what price I wrote and all that. So, that question doesn't arise.
Sure. And any comment on the new product regulations and that could potentially affect
So overall, fairly neutral. Lots of things, Nishin, which are fairly positive, especially in the pension and also in the unit link space. And that should more than offset the brought forward nature of or non-par for policies that are exiting and giving the minimum surrender value. So really a non-event as far as HFC Life is concerned.
But we do believe there are a fair number of customer-friendly measures which have come through on this product, you know, based on the revival period, increase in commutation, many of those. And we also see opportunities in terms of some of the new regulations which have come in terms of smaller tenure products. You know, so overall, we do believe that, look, many of these can work in terms of growing the overall insurance penetration in the country.
And, you know, this is what Suresh mentioned. The shorter tenure products are something that we are anyway working, especially in new ecosystems, and it augurs very well. In fact, this has been our recommendation, and we are very pleased that this has come through.
Just finally, one last question. Any outlook on APE growth that you could share with us for the next 9 months?
We should see next 9 months very robust APE growth. We've done well in quarter one, we think, and should see good amount of traction. Of course, the macro situation continues to remain volatile, but all things being equal, we should see very good levels of APE growth.
Great. Thank you very much and all the best.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Mayank Bukrediwala from Goldman Sachs. Please go ahead.
Hi, Vibha.
Hi, Mayank.
Just want to harp a little bit on the Sanchay Plus product and the interest rate sensitivity around that. I understand that a lot of that hedging is happening on a portfolio basis where you're combining it with lower liability duration products like Credit Life. What I want to understand is what would be your interest rate sensitivity assuming an interest rate move of greater than 100 bips, assuming a 300 bips odd interest rate move or 200 bips interest rate move, because the sort of hedging strategy that you're following over here could introduce a convexity risk.
So it would be very much in line with the numbers we have put out here. If it's plus 1%, or minus 1% that you see here, it should be very much in line. The volumes don't change things very significantly.
So, it would really depend on how well you are matched on your cash flows, right? So, convexity is basically duration matching will only help you manage a certain kind of change in interest rates. Beyond that, cash flow matching is something that is equally or even more important. And provided that you have the discipline of repricing a product in line with the economic environment, a very high chances that you will be able to still contain the sensitivity of the product, both on the embedded value as on the VNB margin. So, and obviously that assumes that the product is still going to be attractive to customers relative to some other product propositions at that point in time.
Understood. If I can put in another question here, in terms of the profitability of the Sanchay Plus product from a NBV margin perspective, this I'm guessing would be lower than your overall margins. Would that be correct?
Not really. Talking about individual segment wise, because it also depends on which channel is selling, and all our channels are selling Sanchay Plus. So it becomes a complex matrix in terms of which channel and which version of Sanchay Plus. So difficult to. So a broad statement, and this is something that we've been saying, all our channels are more than double digit, have been for the past 5 years, more than double digit margin profitable, and we don't write loss making business, or we don't write loss making business into perpetuity for sure. And so all our products are profitable. So, and it really varies in terms of that matrix that I referred to just now on which channel and which sub-channel is selling what product and also to what age group.
Understood. And in terms of repricing of the Sanchay Plus, I mean, we did some repricing recently, but that's not commensurate to the extent that G-Secs have declined. So are we looking at further cutting down the IRRs on that product anytime soon?
So we have an automatic repricing mechanism based on movement in yields. And IRDA has a regulation wherein we can't keep repricing it, say, every week. It has to be a one-month cooling off period. And that's why you might see some lag. But I think rest assured in terms of we would always have our enough reserves to be able to cover in case there's a sharp movement in yields just after we have priced it or reduced the Sanchay Plus rates or any of the non-PAR product rates. So maximum we might be out for maybe a couple of weeks before we can reprice again.
Understood. And sorry if I can just slip in one more, and this one's not on Sanchay but on Credit Life. You've got very good growth for this quarter, but if you sort of look at what's happening on retail loans, we've actually begun to see some sort of slowdown over there. So just want to get a sense on what's still driving a very high level of growth over there, one. And second, in terms of your mix of Credit Life, could you give us a sense how much of that on an AP basis comes from the microfinance segment?
Yeah, so your last question first is about a third is MFI, MFI small finance banks. In terms of, we've grown at 21%. So yes, recent growth just given on the back of all the turmoil that NBFCs and banks are going through. What is important is that while disbursements have definitely gone down and some NBFCs are not disbursing, but our attachment rates have continued to do better. And so we are kind of making up for lower disbursements. And also some of our, and also stepping back, we've always said that about 28% comes from overall HDFC group, and that's continuing to do well. Some of our marquee partners which have anything between 6 to 8% share of our Credit Protect business, and I also mentioned some names like Cholamandalam Finance and Bajaj Finance, etc., they're also continuing to do well. And so it's the 21% growth that we saw isn't really, it's an outcome of all of that put together.
All right. I just add that, you know, even within the CP portfolio, we have a fair number of partnerships which run across various verticals. So, you know, depending on some balance which keeps happening in terms of growth between different partners and different verticals, we manage the overall growth. Of course, you know, we are dependent on the base underlying disbursements by our partner, but then we try and make up by ensuring there is a higher penetration, or we add products like group health or riders, and we try and see what is it that we can offer which will also add value to the customer.
Great. Thanks, Vibha. Thanks, Suresh. This was very helpful.
Thank you.
Thank you. Participants, we may please request you to limit your questions to two per participant. For any further questions, you may come back for a follow-up. The next question is from the line of Prakhar Sharma from CLSA. Please go ahead.
Hi all, great set of numbers, congratulations. Again, I think this is probably going to consume the most of the call, so I'm sticking to the understanding on the guaranteed business. So just a couple of things which I wanted to understand. So basically, the interpretation that I'm taking is that technically we probably interpreted non-PAR product as a guaranteed return product, but technically it is a monthly guaranteed that an insurance company is committing to. Effectively, there is enough flexibility for companies to assess whether existing guarantee is serviceable, profitable, and if not, they can change it. And there are no...
Sir, I just want to interrupt there. No, that is not the case. This is only for new business that we can reprice. Whatever business we've already sold, we can't reprice.
Okay, so if basically, you know, I know you've hedged for existing business. So suppose, rates fall 50-100 basis points and you've hedged it, but because it's a saving product, you would have large ticket size, and I think it's probably the most sold product on the street right now. There will be a sort of a capacity or ceiling that you will hit because the cash flows you are probably, getting from the other products will probably, part of it is required in the ALM bucket that was already done till, the 2-3 quarters back, and part of it can be reallocated in the way you are now thinking of it. Do you think there is a capacity constraint that comes through because it's a saving product, there will be large flows and there is a limit to the existing book that can be reallocated?
Again, without revealing too much in terms of our detailed strategy. Like I mentioned on one of the earlier callers, that we don't see, even for the next 2 or 3 years, if we were to grow by what we have grown in the first quarter of this year, we will not run out of capacity. So there is, as long as all the other businesses that we are currently in continue to grow at the existing rates and not super normal rates, we should be okay. I think Srini mentioned earlier also that in the event that, say, down the line, for whatever reason we don't have, we will not write this business. So in terms of risk mitigation, we are very, very clear that unless we have an internal hedging book within the non-par space, we will not write new business. But as of now, no visibility at all, or no fear at all that we will run out of capacity at this point.
And from the deferred annuity business, the new regulations, could they be positive because they allow better commutation flexibility?
It cuts under this ways. It, you know, there's more commutation, but that gives us, you know, lesser throughput, you know, for annuity. This is on the new products that you're talking
That's
about.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So there would be lesser in terms of what comes through automatically for annuity. So it is both, but it also gives us an opportunity to cross-sell to them. So people who take out a higher amount of commutation, we can cross-sell to them. So yeah, largely, you know, anything that relaxes and gives more flexibility to the consumer, we would see it with a positive lens.
Especially the kind of investments we have made in our NPS subsidiary and the kind of growth that we are seeing on pension, anything which can grow that whole segment is welcome. You know, so
right.
I do believe that, look, this is a great move for us in the pension space.
Yeah.
And just again on the protection side, what would be the lead indicator that you would watch out to, you know, probably control the growth in this product? Like if peers also come up with a similar product or a higher risk product, or it, I don't know what are your assessment of what is basically make or break of change in environment for this product?
So we continue to forge ahead well in terms of overall growth. So protection growth was 63%, like I mentioned. So we're doing well on that. And, you know, what you're saying, Prakhar, is already happening. So either the race to the bottom in terms of price cutting has already happened. Despite that, there will be a sweet spot wherein the consumer wants to differentiate between a brand that can be trusted, a brand that has a very high level of claims payout ratio, like ours, we ended 99% last year, to another also ran kind of a brand. The areas that we would want to avoid, and we see a lot of peer companies going down this path, is in underwriting, and that does worry us. You know, wherein when we have rated up policies, we do find these policies getting converted at normal rates elsewhere, which just means that they're perhaps not pricing for that risk. Often the level of disclosures when they're writing that is also limited. So it's those sorts of things, because it's not just one company versus the other, but it's more in terms of, for an orderly growth of term insurance in India, one needs to have these checks and balances. Otherwise, a regulator clamps down, or there is a lot of public hue and cry, or companies that start making losses down the line after they have sold it, maybe a couple of years, and mortality experience starts kicking in. And you know, it's not to say that we've got it right all the time. We were the early movers in this space, and we've got badly burnt back in time, and we've kind of evolved and learned from our mistakes. We used to sell term policies that were below 50 lakhs, you know, as low as 20 lakhs with very limited underwriting, and we got badly burned there. So I think one needs to be very careful. It's not just a price lever that it is made out to be.
Perfect. Thank you, Vibha.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of M.W. Ken from J.P. Morgan. Please go ahead.
Thank you for this opportunity. And also the congratulations for your very strong result. I have two questions. One is about your balance sheet. So the last 2 or 3 years, and especially this quarter, there has been substantial change on the product mix. So my question is whether this product mix change would also impact on the future, the growth outlook on your free surplus or the back book surplus. the idea is perhaps the previous, the Yuli product would have a very short-term, the profit recognition process versus non-par and other type of product would have their longer period of the profit recognition process. So should we expect the potential, the flow down on the, this back book surplus growth going forward? So any view on this?
Yeah, hi, Kim. You're absolutely right that when you look at the product profile of, or the profile of Indian GAAP profits, if you look at slide 9, and you see the back book loss, so you see for the quarter 4.5 billion, and there is of course a back book profit but offset by the strain. So all of this strain, all things being equal, should unwind exactly like you're alluding to over the next few years. And again, with reasonably conservative assumptions built in here, this should start unwinding. But yes, it does cause a strain when we write some of this business. But hopefully this will come through.
Oh yeah, thank you for this clarity. And the second question is about the distribution. So the company is very active diversifying the distribution, the partner. So in company's point of view, in next 5 years, what would be the optimum mix on the distribution? In next 5 years, what should we think about the real value on the bancassurance distribution? It seems that the overall the industry is trying to the focusing on the non-bancassurance business. So should we actually expecting that distribution channel would provide more cost efficient or the better way to generating the new business, or this is the one way to diversify the potential, the big pressure or the headwind on the bancassurance in the future? So what, how we should think about the potential optimization on the distribution and the why this is the case?
Yeah, so the way I would see it is that agency should certainly go up. This quarter we've ended at 15%. We used to be not long back, about 5 or 6 years ago, agency channel used to contribute 22% to our business. So I would say agency going up to 25%, our own direct channels, which are direct and online, another 25%, maybe a 10%, a 5 to 10%, some of the other channels, broker and small corporate agents, and maybe 40% would remain as bank assurance, is what, how I would see it in the near term, over the next maybe 3-4 years.
Yeah, that's very clear. Thank you so much for this very clear explanation.
Sure, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Harshit Toshniwal from Jefferies. Please go ahead.
Hi, good evening, ma'am. One fundamental question. So when I look at the non-par savings and our approach towards expanding that business mix and then the return guarantee products, clearly we are relying on other products, be it protection, credit life, or different short-term duration products to match the cash flows for the longer one. But in a business where we have experienced volatility in business flows that is linked to market, where we have experienced volatility in even the credit life protection business because of multiple factors. So just wanted to understand that is it actually increasing the balance sheet risks in general, and even more importantly, by making this shift, this ultimately the flow into the non-par savings has actually been coming from the cost of the ULIP and par, because that business has started reducing on the same channel. So shifting the channels and the business mix so quickly over 2 or 3 year period of time, does it make the relationship of bancassurance a bit unstable versus the normal ones?
So actually, Harshit, I'm confused because you started off with product and non-par and you went to bancassurance. So I'll come to that and I'll just ask you a little bit more on that connection. But your first point on non-par, like my opening comments, we would expect to see a lot more normalization of non-par. And like we've always maintained that balanced product mix, so we would see par going up closer to 20% on a full year basis. We would see unit link going up as well. And correspondingly, non-par as a percentage coming down. Non-par will continue to grow non-par, but I think as a percentage, this quarter one has been all eggs in this basket because of the product being sold. But it wasn't entirely, that's how, it wasn't strategized that that's how it should be. And often, you know, different quarters, and even in the past, we've had a particular quarter. For example, if I look at quarter three of, quarter two of last year, especially September, a very high spike in unit link. So this is not the first time, like I said, one-off things. It could be a macro, it could be on the back of a product. In that particular last September, for example, was on the back of a new product launch that we have had, you know, Click to Invest, and we had Click to Wealth, all these in the unit link space, which again caught the imagination of policyholders and did very well. So this is quarter one, so we would see a fair amount of normalization down the line. I didn't quite catch your point on the connect with bank assurance, if you could elaborate.
Right. So when I look at the bank assurance channel, the business which they have been doing, so the increase in the non-par savings product which has come from that particular channel has replaced ULIP and par ULIP business which maybe the bank would have done. So is that is there a cannibalization between the ULIP savings business and the HDFC Life Sanchay business?
The cannibalization means that at the same levels of rupee value, I'm selling one versus the other. That's not the case. Everything is growing. And if you look at just the par, I would just say that just watch this space and you'll be pleasantly surprised.
I think also key to note that Rukar, primary and a lot of our bank assurance business comes from HDFC Bank, and they have a huge growth on their base. So, you know, I mean, frankly, a new launch, whenever it comes in, does show us a spike on one particular range, but it has led to an overall growth. So it's not that it has cannibalized fully, it's just the over a period of time, as they continue to grow at that rate, we will hopefully have more of the newer products on par or UL coming in back again.
So with the change in product mix itself, HDFC Bank has grown at 44%. Right. So the product mix is something that will keep evolving. What we'll be focused on is running a profitable mix and growing the channels.
Okay. And one last question, if I may chip in. So Tata and Birla, do they have similar products in terms of nature like HDFC Life Sanchay? So you have always been one of the innovators in terms of products. So this product, do you see Tata and Birla also offering these kind of non-par guaranteed return?
Difficult to say really what's happening in their table.
Okay. And why is the unwind so low and VIF declining in this particular quarter? More from the EV movement.
Conservatism here, you know, rather than first, you know, coming upon much lower yields and then reacting to it, little bit of conservatism built. Shini, you want to elaborate? Oh.
So yeah, so unwind, we have reduced the rate that we've been using in the past since. Our investment team tells us that, you know, the outlook for the interest rates is actually going to be lower. So a little bit more cautious and we kind of, you know, as a preemptive measure, we reduce it further. So that's the answer.
Okay.
And the reason for VIF going down, I think I explained it earlier, is, you know, because we are writing, you know, non-par products, and as the interest rates go down, you'd appreciate that the VIF falls. But since we are hedged, correspondingly, there will be an uplift in the net worth. So that's why you see that it goes up and the VIF falls. So at the EV level, it's the non-par book is neutral. So that's why you see the movement in the EV level. But within the EV, you see the movement from one component to the other.
Okay. Got it, sir. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Participants, we may request you to please limit your questions to one per participant, as we have several other participants waiting in the queue. For any follow-up questions, you may come back for a follow-up. The next question is from the line of Suresh Ganpati from Macquarie. Please go ahead.
Hi, Vibha. My question is on the Sanchay product. I was going through the brochure and it looks like the effective IRR on this product is only 6% to the customer. I mean, it all depends on the way you calculate. And, you know, there has been a very rapid growth in this product, obviously, and the surrender penalties look like it is 70% in the first couple of years. What I'm trying to decipher is that, and of course, the agency channel has massively sold this product. I mean, how well-trained the agents are and how well-informed the customers are, would there be a chance of mis-selling? is there a proper checks and balance in place? Because we are just worried that there could be a regulatory ire on this product eventually if such kind of stupendous growth continues.
So, good point, Suresh. They actually understand this product better than certainly perhaps a participating product or some of the other products, even a more complicated unit-linked product. They understand that they have to pay X and they will get Y after maybe a holiday of 1 year. So they understand that. They also understand the company cannot reprice the Y no matter what. They understand that. They understand that if unfortunately the policyholder dies during that X period when he's paying, then his family will get whatever the sum assured. These are the three simple things that are there. He also understands that, like you said, 6 or 6.5% he will get tax-free. So actually the construct, when it is explained in this manner, he is able to understand it, I think, fairly well. And as of now, at least we are witnessing, say, in the agency channel, since you mentioned, it is 91% persistency, including the shorter pay products that we have. So, and it was 90% last year when we didn't have this product. So I actually think that in a falling yield scenario, this product will continue to remain persistent. We will also call up people to say not to surrender their policies because they would actually be in the money. Often they might not understand that they're in the money, so that's our job to educate them that interest rates have moved very sharply, which is what the outlook is, and they're in the money, so it doesn't make sense for them to surrender. And we can always give a loan against the policy in case they are in any financial trouble, rather than them surrendering the policy. So don't really see that anything more than what we would see in any other product, for example.
In fact, it's the simplicity of the proposition actually that makes. That made it a big success. You cannot pay X for 10 years or 12 years and you get 2X, 2.25X for the following 12 years. So I believe that it's because of the simplicity it was able to gallop so fast in probably, 1 or 2 months of its launch.
No, but okay. I mean, my point here is for an astute investor, it may still not appeal a 6% return over a period of 15 years. Having said that, just on the surrender penalty, which is so high in the first couple of years, I mean, this would conform with the new IRDA product regulations on surrender charges on non-par products. I mean, there isn't any issue, right? I mean, because it seems to be exceptionally high.
So we will have to refile it, but overall, like I mentioned, overall as HDFC Life, no material impact on margins because we have a balanced portfolio. So we have unit linked also, we have non-par also. Quarter one is perhaps more skewed towards non-par, but other quarters, like I said, have been skewed towards ULIP. So we have a balanced mix of all. So the outcome of the product regulations are something that negate any material impact on margins.
Okay. Thanks, Vibha.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Prateek Poddar from Reliance Nippon Asset Management. Please go ahead.
Hi, Prateek.
Question on slide 20. Yeah, hi, ma'am. Ma'am, on slide 21, if I were to look at the longevity risk for a return of purchase price product, the longevity risk is written as low. I didn't understand that. Could you just help me understand that, ma'am, please?
So this longevity risk is actually because most of the policies that we sell here in the annuity is return of purchase price, which means that supposing a policyholder is going to get X, he gets actually a haircut on the X because at the end, when he is no more, his nominees would get the purchase price back. He's willing to do that because typically an Indian, unlike in the West, wants to leave something to his or her nominee. And so is willing to take a haircut during the person's lifetime. And so that becomes a natural hedge for us.
Yeah. But this...
So, and just to add to that, basically return on premium is some, and if you were just look at the present value of all the flows that the policyholder will get, the longer the person lives, the coupon will continue, but the principal payment will get shifted out. And in present value terms, it moves in both directions. We are kind of managing a longevity risk by returning the premium back to the policyholder's family when the policyholder dies. So basically, it's just time value of money which gets adjusted between coupons and the principal given that it's a single premium product, there's no reinvestment risk, longevity risk gets kind of managed whichever way the mortality or longevity moves at a portfolio level.
And just to add to this, the natural hedge part, which where you say, you know, protection and longevity business, and when I look at this ROPP, how should I link these two? I was a bit confused because I understood this, but then I don't understand the protection and longevity offsetting each other, right? Because if there is no longevity risk in this product, then you understand, right, what I'm trying to.
Yeah. So, see, the thing is, what is there on slide 20 is basically more conceptual in terms of the portfolio of businesses that we write. We don't mean to say that every policy, longevity policy, will kind of cancel off the mortality risk that we write on a term production plan. It's more just to highlight the point that diversified product mix will help you manage each of these risks at a portfolio level. And depending on how, either on a standalone basis or on a portfolio level, you'll be able to look at each of these. So longevity risk gets mitigated by product design, but also when you write mortality. I mean, a perfect hedge would be when you write both the products on the same life. When you don't do that at a portfolio level, it gets a little broader as just pools of risk, which are basically working in different directions. Like the example that we've given on unit-linked and non-par savings as well. They both react differently to change in interest rates. May not be in the same magnitude, but that's basically just the point we're trying to make at a very broad level.
Okay, understand. And just two more questions, if I may. One is on, you talked about product rationalization strategy, which was anticipated. Just on the ticket size also, is it fair to assume that, you know, if I see quarter one growth, entire quarter one growth has come from ticket size increase. So is it fair to assume that going forward, we would see even the ticket sizes getting rationalized as and when the product gets rationalized? Fair to assume that?
Yes, it would get. And if you just look at the NOP also, if we were to exclude health business, it would be 13%. So while it looks like NOP's number of policies have been flat, but actually last year in the first quarter, we wrote, these are very small ticket sized health business, and that health business did not have great persistency. And so we stopped writing that in this quarter. If I were to correct for the impact of the health policies, then it would grow by 13%. But yeah, to your point, the much higher levels of ticket size is on the back of non-par. That also will come off to some extent. And, you know, for example, unit linked, we have never been very enthused by very high ticket size.
Yeah.
So we would not go down that path there.
And ma'am, when you say 13%, this is
the operator.
Yeah, I'm just asking a clarification. This 13% increase is just when you say is the ticket size increase, right? Adjusted for the number of health insurance policies which you have sold.
So NOPs would be 13%. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much. Thanks.
Thank you.
The next question is from the line of Sanket Goda from Spark Capital. Please go ahead.
Thanks for the opportunity. Just going through the VNB walk, which is in the slide number 26, we see that the margin expansion happened, the operating leverage played 300 basis points for the margin expansion. So this operating leverage is basically, we have adjusted our cost which we have experienced in Q1 while reporting the entire margins, or this is still based on the FY19 cost assumption?
No, this is exactly what we have in Q1. So Sanket, as you know, unlike a lot of peer companies, we don't have any straight line basis of cost or estimated cost. What we incur in quarter one is what you see here.
Okay, so basically the cost and cost is mark to market kind of a thing.
Yeah.
But the persistency is based on still the last year. Persistency and mortality is still based on last year's assumption.
Yeah, and we might have slightly strengthened something if we found any adverse. Not that we have anything significant, but I'm just saying philosophically speaking, yeah, typically it would be we do this once a year in March. Beyond that, if we feel the need to strengthen our persistency assumptions, which means make it more conservative, we might do that. But usually it's once a year.
So the clarification, if for example in the next 9 months the growth slows down to some extent, moderates to say 25-30% growth compared to 63, then the operating leverage, which is 300 basis point, will moderate over a period of time.
Yes, as a percentage it would, yes.
So the margins, which delta you got it from 300 basis point, will to some extent moderate. If the product mix also moves in favor of ULIPs and PAR, then maybe for the full year margins will not be true to the extent what we have seen in Q1.
So our full year margins would be robust. It would be smooth upward curve. We ended at 24.6 last year. There will be a balanced product mix that we will pursue or we think that we can get to a balanced product mix over the next 3 quarters. So that's what you'll have to factor in terms of margins.
Okay, and just one more thing, if I can...
Excuse me, this is the operator. Mr. Gowda, may we request you to come back in the queue for a follow-up, please?
Sure, sure. No.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Dhaval Gada from DSP Mutual Fund. Please go ahead.
Hi, Vipa. Congratulations on good set of numbers. Just a couple of clarifications. First, internally, do we have a cap around the amount of deferred annuities that we want to underwrite? That's the first question. And second is, just on slide 21, one clarification. In the past, you explained this internal cash flow hedge that we have. If you could just elaborate with an example, that would be very useful. Yeah, thank you.
So, Dhaval, on the first one, do we have a cap? No, we don't have a cap, except that goes back to what all of us have alluded to about having a balanced product mix. So, in that context, we will continue to diversify what we sell and also see the needs-based analysis. And in that context, we would see some rationalization happening, which means that unit link and PAR also will pick up, and we are fairly confident of that.
Just to add to that, to your point on deferred annuities, again, product design is one way we are very, very closely monitoring in terms of the deferral period as well as the age at which we write. So we put that again on slide 20 in terms of both of these elements. The average age at which we write the annuity business is 59 years, so we are not really writing this at young lives. And also in terms of deferment period is less than 4 years, which is again the way in which we want to manage our reinvestment risk. So it's clearly both of these elements which are very critical to ensure that we are able to manage the interest rate sensitivity on our annuity portfolio on a standalone basis, as we've highlighted on slide 21.
Sure. On the second one, just on the internal cash flow hedge.
So that, again, we've discussed a few times on the call. Yes, the ability to write non-par savings is dependent on our ability to continue to write shorter liability products on the protection side. We've said that earlier, and we've reiterated that on the call. And like Vibha mentioned, we have enough visibility in terms of cash flows coming from other parts of our business to be able to write this. And yes, that will be the natural cap. Without which we will not be able to manage this internally. And as we've said, that we have a fairly long runway to go there. The last box on slide 20 is basically what we will have access to if we want to really go beyond what we have internal in the company, which is basically any sort of external hedges that we can get over a period of time. At this point in time, it's all based on internal ability to manage this risk.
Understood. Thank you and all the best.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Nidesh Jain from Investec. Please go ahead.
Thanks for the opportunity. I have put a Sanchay Life Plus product. What is the average IRR that we have been promising in Q1? Because there are 3-4 variants and the IRRs are quite different in all these 4 variants.
Yeah, it's close to 6% now that we also repriced it.
Yeah. 6%
but
at 6% IRR, we must be assuming that our investment return will be around 8.5 to 9% to make decent money on the product, given the acquisition cost and all related cost. So are we having such instruments to invest for next 12-24 years which are yielding those sort of returns?
So you've made some assumption on the spreads that we really need to basically get to this level. That may not really be the case. The spreads that we work with are probably different from what you're suggesting. And what is available in the market is something that we would try and reflect in our price as dynamically as we can. Like Vibha mentioned, there is once a month that we can do this, and we've just done one repricing after launch last month, and we plan to do one shortly as well.
Yeah, so the spreads are nowhere what you've said. They're far more wafer thin than what you've said.
Sure. Because what I want to understand is, because a lot of peers are saying that it's a LAP-supported product. So if a hypothetically a customer continues with you for the entire duration, is it still making money for the company, or is it just that customer? Or
So in that case, to the earlier question that I think Srini answered as to lab support, then it would reflect a lot more in terms of our persistency assumptions or, you know, when in a falling yield scenario, I don't see, I think if we were to bank this as being lab supported, like I know that some of the smaller insurance companies have done that in the past, I think it would be fairly, very, very risky strategy, and I think that's something that I don't think it augurs very well with corporate governance of a company to say that you're writing business to make it lab supported and that's what makes margins. I don't even know how to answer that question.
Sure. But for a customer who will stay with us for the entire term, it still will be a margin accretive for us.
Yeah, very much. I have bought this product.
Sure. Thank you. That's it for me.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Prashant Kothari from Pictet. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi. One question on this Sanchay Plus. I understand that the liability profile is probably matched for the first year premium that you are getting. But what about the future premiums? Because if, let's say, for whatever reason, the premiums on the protection or the credit side drop a lot, how would we kind of match the liability profiles?
So we have mentioned this earlier on the call that basically this is a regular premium product, anywhere between 5 years to 10 years, and the fact that we're talking about duration matching and cash flow matching is basically to cover both interest rate risk as well as reinvestment risk, and reinvestment risk is from future premiums, which basically does get matched both on the duration side as well as on the cash flow side through different liability product categories that we have. So it's not just covering the first premium, it's also covering future premiums as well from products which have actually bought assets to be able to help us manage this risk both for duration as well as cash flows. And then there are ways in which we are absolutely able to deal with this internally, some of it which we've shared with you on the call. The rest of it we believe is proprietary. We'd like to kind of keep it with us. So we would just urge you to look at the results, and we are absolutely clear that this is something that we watch very closely, and we will share this with you every quarter in terms of how this is panning out.
If I could make a broader point, given that we have about 10 minutes or so left, if any further questions are there on this particular product, then we could perhaps take it offline, because I think that we've covered every aspect of this product. And if there are any other questions that people on this call would like to ask, then happy to take those questions.
Okay, sorry, just one more question.
Excuse me, this is the operator. Mr. Kothari, may we request you to come back in the queue for a follow-up, please?
Okay.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Nishant Shah from Macquarie. Please go ahead.
Right. So one thing I noticed in this time's presentation, your ROEV is not changing materially. In fact, it's like going down like maybe 2 basis points or something. So it's at 19.9. So do we understand that like these non-par products are a lot more capital intensive, and though margins may be higher or like, you know, some productivity gains would be higher, in terms of return on capital, they're not really that changing the profile that much for the whole company?
Not really, because if you compare like for like quarter one of this year versus last year was 18.4% and this year 19.9%. So there has been a meaningful expansion of ROEV. And as you know, on a full year basis, especially when you include the uplift that you get in quarter four because of the higher volumes, that comparison would not be the right comparison.
Okay, fair enough. And one more question. Just in this quarter, because we've seen a lot of growth in these non-par products, still somehow we're seeing a sequential rise in solvency. So how does that happen?
So because usually if you look at every quarter one, it is the solvency you'll find is higher than quarter four. So this is just a seasonality of it. And that's why you will see, I'm guessing that you're comparing it with
4Q,
yeah. But you will find that when you look at Q1 of last year, it will be higher than March of the previous year.
What explains this seasonality?
Basically, in Q1, what happens is that the growth in PAT is higher than the required solvency margin growth. So that basically kind of adds to solvency.
That's what happens pretty much every first quarter.
Okay, fair enough. And just one small clarification.
Mr. Shah, may we request to come back in the queue, please?
This is very, very tiny question. So, if 15% going to 58% in non-par, I'm making the assumption that 58% includes Sanchay, Sanchay Plus. Hello?
Yes, yes, it does.
Yes, and all the variants include, including the lifelong variants,
yes.
Which, and they're not classified under annuity, they're classified here under non-par, correct?
Correct, yeah.
Okay, yep, yep. That's it for me. Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Prakash Kapadia from Anived PMS. Please go ahead.
Thanks. My questions have been answered.
Thank you, Prakash.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of HR Gala from Finvest Advisors. Please go ahead.
My questions are also answered.
Thanks, Prakash. Gala.
The next question is from the line of Raj Rishi, an individual investor. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted some feedback as to what would be your, reasonable aspiration as far as ROE is concerned over a period of time, say 3 to 5 years. If you can give some comment on that.
See, ROE, you will agree that is anyway healthy than I think any other industry that I can think of in the BFSI sector. Right. So we don't really project our ROE, reason being that even Indian GAAP is really an outcome of what is it that we are selling. And you'll also see that the 12% growth in PAT is really very different from the traction that we've seen in margins or ROEV. And so ROE, I think we're a little bit way off from becoming a mature company and it's really ROE driven. But we would expect to see a lot of unwinding of the business, good business that we are writing right now, reserving for it, and over the tenure of the policies, unwinding of those profits. So ROE should move upwards, but really it's ROEV that at this point in time that we are focused on. ROE okay. Is more of an outcome. Yeah.
Okay. So thanks, ma'am.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Avinash Singh from SBI Cap Securities. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi. One small thing. There has been a sharp increase in your investment provision for standard and non-standard, both in the policyholder account and shareholder accounts. Can you just provide some color on which investment has happened? And also on the policyholder account, the taxes, I mean, of course, has, provision for taxes has, I mean, dropped on YOY comparison as well. So just two clarifications.
So on the second point, Avinash, it's dropped because of, the way taxation works is that the projection of how much each component of your underlying emergence of FOMI surplus as well as what is the dividend cover that we have, what is the mix of pension, and that can vary. You're looking at quarter one. This will normalize as we go for the full year. It will not be very different in terms of effective tax rate versus.
Okay.
Yeah. Your first question I didn't really get. Can you just, something about shareholders and policyholders, can you just...
Yeah, in both they count the provisions for your standard and non-standard investments in Q1 FY20 is meaningfully higher. I mean, it's almost comparable to the full year 19.
Yeah.
So, could you provide which investments in particular? I mean,
Avinash, I don't want to give script-wise, but some of the usual names that have, that are undergoing some pain. And it is based on, it's rule-based. Wherein if the script equity drops a particular percentage, then over the period, then it's similar to the RBI rules.
Okay, so it's equity or debt? I mean, in debt, I think you have 15% in year one or something like that?
Yeah, it's both.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
But none of the big names, if to give you comfort. ILNFS, I've said in the past, we had 65 crores wherein... 75% of that has been written down. And when you say 65 crores in the context of our assets under management of 1.3 trillion, it's really nothing.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Vinod Rajamani from HSBC. Please go ahead.
Thank you for this. I wanted to know the split of this this deferred annuity product. What is the split in terms of how much is return of premium and say non-return of premium, both on the on both the two variants.
Thank you, sir.
So we have this on, given this on slide 20, wherein we're talking about 95%.
Okay, okay. And what is the rate that you offer? What is the differential in terms of the return of premium and the what
it,
is the
it varies very it varies quite a bit, Vinod, between what age group, etc. So
yeah, but on average for the same cohort, how much would it be?
It's about 2% lower.
Okay, okay.
Thank
yeah,
you.
Understood. Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Neeraj Toshniwal from MK Global. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Congrats on great set of numbers. Just wanted to understand what kind of IR we are offering in terms of deferred annuity and immediate annuity vis-a-vis Sanchay Plus. I mean, how different it
is? So, you know, if we could take the questions on this offline, like I mentioned, I'd really appreciate it.
Just a bit on that, if at all you can answer that one. How much would be the IR be on the
IRR on?
On the deferred annuity and with the annuity vis-a-vis Sanchay Plus. Just wanted to understand.
That's a little bit more, I think, involved. You know, you're comparing different products, etc. So, no, can't, it's difficult to give a simple answer to that.
Okay. Any color?
Anything else that you wanted to ask?
So, are we clubbing into pension group variable, this deferred annuity, immediate annuity, and Sanchay Plus in the annuity business, non-PA annuity?
Okay. Annuity is in the pension segment, Sanchay Plus is in the non-par life segment. So we are not clubbing the two. So it's basically...
No, it's non-par is only non-par. Right. Annuity separately is carved out there in that slide where 15.
No, no, actually in the LOD, there is a division non-par annuity business and non-par pension group variable. And that has also grown a lot. I mean, that has become 3.9% of APE just from 1.6%. So just wanted to know what has led to such sharp rise into the pension group variable coming from the deferred annuity, immediate annuity or anything else as well?
Group funds. They are group funds business.
The fund administration business, group gratuity superannuation.
So that would be a little lower margin business if I am correct. So there's a flow business, fund flow business just led to such sharp increase in the pension group variable.
That's correct, and the pension business is a feeder into our annuity business.
What you're saying is a volume, and we do a fair amount of volume there. It's not a percentage, right? So you can't really make out in terms of what is it as a percentage.
Okay, okay, got your point.
Because LODR would have the rupee value.
Got your point. And
this is the operator. Mr. Toshniwal, may we request you to come back in the queue, please?
Sure. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The next question is from the line of Sanket Ghoda from Spark Capital. Please go ahead.
Thanks for the opportunity. So the annuity rate for a 60-year guy, we are offering it around 7.2, immediate annuity return of purchase. And the GSEC rates are, as of now, trading below 7% or closer to 7%. So looking at that thing, we see that the margins made on immediate annuity return of purchase would be significantly lower. Or that is because in multiple times in the call we have mentioned that it is backed by GSEC paper. So my understanding is right, or we will be in a future probably our GSEC yield average was better than 7.2, and therefore we are making margins there, and we will reset in the subsequent quarter. Therefore the margins remain intact.
Yeah, it's a combination of both. We will reprice this at the next possible opportunity, and the asset allocation between immediate and deferred annuity is a combination of largely GSECs but some corporate bonds as well. So the yield pickup comes from there as long as we are able to match the duration for both the immediate and deferred annuity portfolio as a whole. That's how we are basically managing that book.
But bulk of the investment backing the annuity AUM is GSECs.
It has some corporates as well, not 100% GSEC. You have state bonds, you have corporates, which are all, you know, slightly, they give a decent spread over the GSEC.
Okay. And one last question, if I can chip in. A&W growth, if you see in the slide, it has grown by 11 billion rupees from last March to June. But in balance sheet, we have grown it by 400 crores. And economic variance is just 80 crores. So I'm not able to understand what that 6 crores is coming from, 600 crores is coming from.
It's because of the MTM. In A&W, you're looking at the balance sheet, right, in A&W. So there it's amortized. But what you see in the MCEV is MTM.
So that MTM is captured as economic variance, right, if I'm not wrong, of 80 crores?
No, not. So you see the MTM there and here may not be exactly matching. there'll be a
okay. Because my understanding was that economic variance, which we see generally for any insurance company, it is basically M2M gain on the fixed income portfolio.
That's in excess of expected return. Anything in excess of expected return is economic variance. The rest flows in operating.
Rest flows directly into A&W, you mean to say, right?
Yes.
So we have an MTM gain of around 600 crores in the current quarter. Hello?
Yeah.
Hi, so just I was asking, we have an MTM gain of around 600 crores in the current quarter on the fixed income portfolio. I mean, that reading is right if I back calculate it?
Yeah, so there is an offsetting effect between the WIF and the A&W. Right, so that's basically what happens when interest rates move in a particular direction. It affects WIF in one direction, the A&W in another. So that's basically the offsetting impact that we were just talking about.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Atul Mehra from Motilal Oswal Asset Management. Please go ahead.
Yeah. Good evening, and thanks for the opportunity. Sorry for asking a question to do with the same product. But ma'am, just one thing in terms of given the attractiveness of the product for say investors and distributors alike, so do you see this product actually displacing a lot of say mutual fund flows or otherwise other insurance flows or debt flows of any kinds? Because given I think the current environment and do you see this particular thing panning out? And in this context, how do you see this product scaling going forward? Because one of the comments you mentioned on the call was there's no limit as to what you're looking at. So even if it's 50% of the book now in terms of incrementally, you're okay maybe going even higher. So is there anything on that sort of how scalable this can be going forward for you?
So it can be scalable. And having said that, right sale of the fitment has to be right to the customer who is looking to lock in his long-term savings into a particular rate, not necessarily having an equity upside, for example, so or not only looking at a protection product. So it depends on what the customer is looking at. On your question about whether it's going to displace something, I think insurance is overall fairly under-penetrated. So even without beginning to displace some other part of the BFSI in terms of savings, I think there's enough in terms of offering this as a niche product for people who are reasonably risk-averse, who want to lock in these rates, especially during their retirement period. So it's a very good product. And again, I want to put things into context. You know, we've been the innovator, whether in cancer care or whether in some of the joint life unit-linked variants. So while we're talking a lot about this product, we've been there and done it on various other products, especially when we go to the market with something new, there is a lot of interest
Just one more clarification on this, because in the past, what we've always done and demonstrated is we wouldn't like any particular product to be predominant part of our sales pool. So why is this time, why is it different this time?
Because you're looking at only one quarter.
Okay.
And you know, on your earlier question in terms of what we can scale and whether it can displace some of the other BFSI products, I think we do have a lot of other good products on the UL side which we can clearly target against the MF segment. So we have products like Classic One, we have products like Click 2L, which by itself can come back and scale up. So you know, over a period of time, term opportunity is huge, the annuity opportunity is huge, the ULIP products which can displace the MF is huge, so I do believe it will balance out as a product portfolio.
Right. Great. Thanks and wish you all the best.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was the last question. I now hand the conference over to Ms. Vibha Padalkar for closing comments.
Thank you everyone for a patient listening and thank you all for your questions. As mentioned, the detailed disclosure on our results is available in our investor presentation. I would like to thank all of you for participating in our quarterly results call. Good night.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of HDFC Life, we conclude this conference. Thank you for joining us and you may now disconnect your lines.